Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. Please let my brother be more than another face on a T-shirt. That was the central, piercing plea of Philonis Floyd, the younger brother of George, as he spoke to the Judiciary Committee of the US House of Representatives today. The question that's been asked insistently since George Floyd's death under the knee of a white police officer is whether this could be a turning point in the decades-old, centuries-old fight against racial inequality. Today, that question came to Capitol Hill. Its answer will depend on whether another unwanted norm can be overturned, that politics in Washington is paralyzed by partisanship in a presidential election year, all the more so. Often at these moments, we'll play you a clip or two from the evidence, often lasting 20, 30 seconds. We're going to give you slightly longer to the first person to speak before the House Judiciary Committee, George Floyd's brother, Philonis.
To make sure that he is more than another face on a T-shirt, more than another name on a list that won't stop growing, George always made sacrifices for our family. And he made sacrifices for complete strangers. He gave the little that he had to help others. He was our gentle giant. I was reminded of that when I watched the video of his murder. He called all the officers, sir. He was mild-mannered. He didn't fight back. He listened to all the officers. The man who took his life, who suffocated him, for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, he still called them sir as he begged for his life. I can't tell you the kind of pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to your whole entire life, die begging for his mom. I'm tired. I'm tired of pain. Pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to for your whole life, die begging for his mom? I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Stop the pain. Stop us from being tired. George called for help, and he was ignored. Please listen to the calls I'm making to you now, to the calls of our family and the calls ringing out the streets across the world. People of all backgrounds, genders, and races have come together to demand change. Honor them. Honor George and make the necessary changes that make law enforcement the solution and not the problem. Hold them accountable when they do something wrong. Teach them what it means to treat people with empathy and respect. Teach them what necessary force is. Teach them that deadly force should be used rarely and only when life is at risk. George wasn't hurting anyone that day. He didn't deserve to die over $20. I'm asking you, is that what a black man is worth? $20? This is 2020. Enough is enough. The people marching in the streets are telling you enough is enough. By the leaders that in our country, the world needs the right thing. The people elected you to speak for them, to make positive change. George's name means something. You have the opportunity here today to make your names mean something too. If his death ends up changing the world for the better, and I think it will, then he died as he lived. It is on you to make sure his death is not in vain. I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to Perry while he was here. I was robbed of that. But I know he's looking down at us now. Perry, look up at what you did, big brother. You changed the world. Thank you for everything, for taking care of us on earth, for taking care of us now. I hope you found mama and you can rest in peace with power. Thank you.
Felonis Floyd, brother of George, in his opening statement to the House Judiciary Committee today. And that question that often emerges out of turmoil and anguish, will it be different now? In this case, in the aftermath of his brother's death, will the long unfinished business of the civil rights movement move a little further forward? One way to assess that is to ask those with the longest memories. Claiborne Carson is now a professor of history at Stanford University. Back in 1965, he was a student at the other end of California, at UCLA. He was an activist and took part in the 6-day-long confrontation and disorder that became known as the Watts Riots or Watts Rebellion. How did today's protests compare with those of the 60s?
There are important similarities and differences. I think the similarities from the 60s that I remember is that young people often took the lead. The sit-ins of 1960, started by four teenagers in Greensboro, North Carolina, spread throughout the South. And that was one of the turning points in the Southern struggle because it meant the entry of lots of young people, college students, high school students, and the tactic of the sit-in was ideally suited to them. That's certainly a similarity. What is really different is the speed at which this protest has expanded throughout the nation and throughout the world.
Some people might wonder whether with speed comes the possibility that the protests and the movement and that sense of momentum will ebb just as quickly. We'll have this gust of outrage and people saying something has to change, something has to be done now. But in a week or two, the clamor will subside and the political bandwagon will move on.
Certainly, we can't expect these protests to remain at this scale. But I think one thing that's important to point out is that young people have lots of time on their hands these days. Before the protests, many of them were stuck at home. Many of them had lost their jobs. The school year is over. I remember seeing a quote from one of the protesters who said, "We have nothing but time on our hands." That's one of the advantages of being young, in particular during this period. The alternatives to protesting, when you might have just lost your job or you can't go to college, can't go back to high school, protest is probably one of the things that you can still do.
Is another difference that you are seeing now, maybe just on the fringes, but you're seeing a wider spectrum of political involvement in these protests? I mean, you're seeing, for example, police officers themselves joining protests and flashing peace signs. You're seeing, I mean, he is to an extent out on a limb within the Republican Party, but Senator Mitt Romney has gone out on a march. Is this something that you think is significant, or is it just something which is tokenistic? Where do you stand on that?
There's always a chance that joining in the protests at this moment might be hypocritical, tokenistic, as you put it. But I prefer to say that the point of the protests is to mobilize not just young people who are already convinced that the police have gone too far too many times, but rather to convince other people who have not really paid attention to this issue. And I think that's the real advantage of, or the real accomplishment of young people. You know, just imagine if George Floyd had been killed and only people beyond the age of 30 were counted upon to respond to that. Would there have been protests? I'm not sure that there would have been. And certainly there would have been much smaller protests and much less sustained because somehow people over 30 had become accustomed to seeing this. And this was simply another police killing. You know, we have 1,000 of them a year in this country. So it's easy to get acclimated to that.
You're not the first historian I've asked this question of, and each time I have, I've prefaced it by saying this is entirely unfair because a historian is paid to look back rather than forwards. But a lot of people are saying this could well be a turning point, an inflection point in history. What's your best guess?
I think so. I think this is as important a moment, not just these protests, but the ones before it, going back to the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, which were mobilized, the previous protests over police killings, but also in a broader sense, the response of young people to the mass killing at the Parkland High School in Florida, which led to 1 million people, most of them young, coming to Washington, D.C., again an event larger than the March on Washington.
which hasn't led to meaningful gun reform.
Well, we could also say that the protests of the 60s did not solve the problem of discrimination, but it did lead to some legislation. It led to pulling down whites-only signs. We're never going to get a series of protests that leads to a peaceful and just world. That's an accomplishment that's always in the future. You know, when Martin Luther King said the moral arm of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice, he didn't say how quickly it bends. And I think that that's for this generation and future generations to kind of make the world better than the world they came into. And that's the accomplishment of my generation during the 60s. You know, we did make the world better than the world we were born into, but we didn't make it perfect. I think if someone had told me that we would still be dealing with a problem that I saw firsthand when I was in Los Angeles back in 1965, when police killed 34 people and all of them were deemed justifiable homicides. That was just in a few days. And they were not using rubber bullets, they were using lead bullets. So I've seen both positive change, but then I also have that sense, here we go again. If someone had told me, yes, your grandkids will still be living in a world where police can kill people with impunity, that would have been pretty depressing. But it would, if anything, I would hope that that would have made me work even more diligently and keep your eyes on the prize. And it's always going to be out in the future when we live in a world of human rights and social justice.
Professor Claiborne Carson, and just in the last hour, President Trump's press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, has been speaking to the press at the White House. This was the first question she faced. It was about the president's response to another video clip involving the police. Two officers in Buffalo pushing over a 75-year-old protester as he approached them.
Does the president regret tweeting out a baseless conspiracy theory about a 75-year-old protester on the morning of George Floyd's funeral?
The president was asking questions about an interaction in a video clip he saw, and the president has the right to ask those questions.
But does he regret tweeting out this protester was assaulted?
The president does not regret standing up for law enforcement men and women across this country. And let me say this, and just give you a little bit about the mindset behind the president's tweet. Look, we're living in a moment that is, it seems to be reflexively anti-police officer. And it's unacceptable to the president. In this tweet that he sent out, he was in no way condoning violence. He was not passing judgment on these two officers in particular. But what he was saying is this. When we see a brief snippet of a video, it's incumbent upon reporters and those who are surveying the situation to ask questions.
Ask questions is one of the things we try and do here on NewsHour. And coming up on our program, a warning that hundreds of thousands of children in India could die of hunger caused by the impact of the lockdown.
We used to cook rice, rotis and vegetables before the lockdown. Our children ate well. Now they remain hungry because we have no money and no work.
That report from India in just over 10 minutes. Headlines this hour. The brother of George Floyd, the African-American who died while being restrained by U.S. police, has told a congressional committee that people around the world are demanding changes to policing practices. And the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has promised an inquiry into the mistreatment of foreign reporters covering the nationwide protests. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. At least 15 people have been killed by the police during the dusk to dawn curfew in Kenya. It's meant to curb the spread of coronavirus. That figure is according to a report by the country's independent police oversight authority, who say that six police officers will now be charged with murder and assault for their alleged involvement in shootings while enforcing the restrictions. The BBC's Mercy Juma has this report. I should warn you, some of the details are distressing.
Through several narrow alleys, Hussein Moyo leads me to his home in Madare, an informal settlement in Nairobi. Children run past quickly through the interconnected corridors, jumping over open sewage. Hussein's house is in a maroon and cream-colored three-story flat sandwiched between two others. He points to the topmost balcony where a heavy load of clothes hangs on drooping lines.
That is my house. That is where my son was when the bullet hit him.
Moyo's 13-year-old son, Yassin, was allegedly shot in the stomach by police after a dusk-to-dawn curfew was implemented in Kenya in a bid to prevent the spread of coronavirus. He had been standing together with his family on their third-floor balcony, watching police storm the neighborhood in search of people who were not abiding by the curfew.
Neighbors waliona ni kitu ilikuwa saa moja hivi.
Everyone saw him. His gun had a powerful light on it. I do not know if I will get justice. So many people have died in similar manners, and here in Kenya, justice is a dream. It takes forever for a case to come to conclusion.
Yassin's case is one of those confirmed by the Police Oversight Authority, and now the Director of Public Prosecutions has approved the arrest and prosecution of a police officer. During the curfew period, at least 14 other people have been killed and dozens others injured, allegedly by police, according to the Independent Police Oversight Authority. I have just crossed to the other side of town. This is Kibera, another informal settlement in Nairobi. Several people are gathered in front of a wall on which a huge mural is painted on. There is an image of a police officer with a baton stepping on a protester. And next to it is a list of names of young men who locals here say were killed by police. One of the names is that of Moyo's son, 13-year-old Yassin Moyo. The first of George Floyd, the African-American man who died in U.S. police custody 2 weeks ago, is also freshly painted here. 25-year-old Daniel Okoth is one of the youth leaders who spearheaded the project.
We didn't do it to please America. We did it to put like a statement, you know, a statement to the world. Many youths lost their lives, you know, in the hands of police, you know, here in Kibera. And we don't get justice, you know, mistaken identity, extrajudicial killings, you know, police brutality.
In a conversation with the BBC, Kenya's police spokesperson Charles Owino said the findings in the IPOA report were simply allegations and complaints filed by the public, and every case mentioned would need to be investigated. On the case of Yassin Moyo, he said the shooting was accidental as the police officer wanted to disperse the crowd and wanted to shoot into the air. He said it was unfair to portray the police as killers at a time when they are on the front line enforcing measures such as the curfew aimed at stopping the spread of COVID-19. The government says it has pumped millions of dollars into police service reforms since the 2007-2008 post-election violence, which left more than 1,000 people dead and at least 300,000 displaced. Police were accused of causing up to 400 of the deaths. But critics say little has changed, and people in settlements like Mathare say they want justice.
That was Mercy Juma reporting from Kenya. It was back in 1986 that the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was shot dead in the street. He'd been on the way home with his wife after going to the cinema in Stockholm. For 34 years, his murder has remained a mystery, until today, when Swedish prosecutors named the man they said was the assassin, a graphic designer called Stig Engström. He killed himself in 2000, so the prosecutors say the case has to be considered now closed. Martin Palmer is the former Prime Minister's son. He's been speaking to NewsHour. Does today give his family a degree of closure?
I think so, yeah. I think the prosecutor today was very good. He was very systematic and presented the evidence very carefully. However, it was, of course, a bit disappointing that they didn't have more conclusive evidence, DNA or a weapon that they could trace to the crime.
The Prime Minister's, Olaf Palmer's son, Martin, speaking to NewsHour a little earlier. The BBC's Maddie Savage has been speaking to the head of the investigation. He's called Hans Mellander. She's been speaking to him through a translator. How sure is he that Engström was the killer?
Nej, det är ju så att jag tror inte att varken jag eller åklagare Petersson har sagt att det är säkra på Per Engström.
No, I don't think that either Christopher Peterson or myself have said that we are sure that Engström is the perpetrator. No, we've said that this is a theory, that Engström is a suspect in that way, and in fact, as such, he would have been taken into custody, in fact, had he been alive.
This has left a lot of Swedes today on social media suggesting that they haven't really had closure for a case that's haunted the country for more than 30 years. What's your message for them today?
Jag har förståelse för det. Vi kan ju bara göra en polisiär utredning.
I fully understand their feelings, actually, and the only thing that we can do, really, is we can conduct a police investigation. The prosecutor, then, he makes a legal assessment, and his view is that Engström is a suspect in this case, and then, therefore, the decision has been to drop the investigation as he is deceased. And I understand, and bearing in mind that we haven't been able to say that we are 100% sure here is the solution to this matter, there are a lot of questions still remaining.
What about the possibility of another person being involved? How confident are you that this was a lone killer?
Vi har ju tittat ganska mycket på den frågan, huruvida Engström är en ensam agerande gärningsman.
Well, we have in fact asked ourselves that question about Engström, whether he was in fact a lone assassin or whether he was part of some kind of conspiracy. But we haven't seen, I mean, we've really looked at this and we haven't seen any signs that he was part of a group or part of any kind of conspiracy. And our view is that after our examination of all the material is that he was a lone assassin.
What do you make of all of the global attention on this, the fact that a case of from 34 years ago is still capturing the attention not just of Swedes but of people around the world? What does that say about this particular case and Olof Palme?
Ja, det säger väl en hel del om Olof Palme som person, tycker jag, och hans engagemang i olika frågor.
Well, I think it says quite a lot about Olof Palme himself as a person, actually, in the way that he was so committed to so many different important questions.
The prosecutor who led that investigation, Hans Mellander, and he was speaking to the BBC's Maddie Savage. Hans Mellander also said to reporters that he wasn't, as he put it, stupid enough to believe that the conclusions of this painstaking investigation would put an end to the huge number of conspiracy theories that have surrounded Olof Palme's assassination. You're listening to News Hour. We've got much more to come in the next 30 minutes. If you can, please stay with us. Next on News Hour, the controversy over deciding how George Floyd died. Before that, there's a warning from public health experts that in India, nearly 300,000 children could die from severe malnutrition over the next 6 months. The country's daily wage earners have suffered the most during the coronavirus lockdown, with millions struggling to feed their families. Divya Arya has this report from Delhi.
I'm in this vast open ground near a slum outside the capital Delhi, where two volunteers have come to distribute food packets. But as soon as they started, they were surrounded by scores of children. Hunger has always been an issue in low-income communities, but this desperation is new. These children's families have no jobs anymore, so it feels like a fight for survival. A few kilometers away, in a colony lined with bungalows, is a small tent pitched on an empty plot. Shiva, just 1 month old, lives here with his six siblings. His parents are construction workers and rely on daily wages to buy food. Like millions of others, Phoolmati Devi and her husband lost work after the government announced a lockdown in March.
We used to cook rice, rotis and vegetables before the lockdown. Our children ate well. Now they remain hungry because we have no money and no work.
Apart from Shiva, two sisters are under 5 years, the age when children are most vulnerable to severe malnutrition. India is already the worst in the world, with 1 in 5 children affected. Now studies suggest that might have become much worse. Harriet Torles is the regional head of nutrition at UNICEF.
So this is almost the perfect storm for malnutrition in this region, with a very vulnerable population, with declining quality and quantity of diets, and without the access to the essential services that children need.
For more than 45 years, the Indian government has run a child development scheme to provide essential vitamins and nutrients to children up to the age of 6 through centers known as the Anganwadis. But during the coronavirus lockdown, most of the more than 1 million Anganwadi centers were shut down. Now some of them are trying to home deliver a much smaller quantity of food supplements at a time when they're most critical for young children's development.
Now it's ordinary citizens who have stepped up, like Neelesh Singh, who has been cooking food with the help of his family and funds raised through his NGO. He has been distributing one hot meal a day to 500 children since the past 2 months. But that's hardly enough.
I can provide one or two meals, but children need breakfast, lunch and dinner. They're not getting the nutrition they need.
Despite a surge in coronavirus cases, the lockdown is easing. The government has a huge dilemma: how to stop the deadly spread of the disease and protect the most vulnerable.
That was Divya Arya reporting from Delhi. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service in London with me, Tim Franks. One of the reasons George Floyd's protracted, terrible death has had such a global impact is that it was, of course, captured on camera over more than 8 pitiless minutes as he lay pinned to the road, face squashed, neck squeezed by that police officer's knee. His death is now the subject of a murder charge against that police officer, Derek Chauvin. And already there appears to be some disagreement over precisely what caused George Floyd's death, given that there have been 2 autopsies which appear to have reached slightly different conclusions. The first came from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner. Dr. Michael Baden is the pathologist hired by the family to give a second opinion.
The family was concerned and wanted a second opinion. And I and Dr. Wilson did a second autopsy, and we found definitely that they died because of the restraint. Our conclusion was compression of the neck and of the back is what caused his death by not being able to breathe by asphyxia. The wording's a little different. The wording's a little different with the official cause of death by the medical examiner. He had drugs in his bloodstream, fentanyl and other drugs, serious drugs, and he had some hardening the arteries, the coronary arteries. We take the victim as we find him. In this instance, it's my opinion, clearly, he died because of the restraint. To the extent that there may be a claim, which I'm not sure of, that there were other causes of his death, I would disagree. He has other abnormalities, but none of them caused the death.
Have you actually been able to examine the body in terms of being able to get tissue samples and the rest of it? Or is this just a sort of preliminary investigation by you?
No. Somebody gets shot in the street, dead. The police will take into custody the person who did it. And the next day, the medical examiner will come up and say, the cause of death is gunshot wound to the head. Before anything else comes in, the alcohol, the microscopic slides, whatever else, may be factors in evaluating why it all happened, but the cause of death is the gunshot wound to the head. And what I would say here, in my opinion, if they hadn't restrained him, he wouldn't have died, even though he had a lot of drugs in his body, even though he had some coronary or heart disease. But that isn't what caused his death. What caused his death was the way he was restrained and couldn't breathe. And that's my opinion about it. To the extent that other factors are brought in, I think they help deter, give an idea of what was happening, perhaps why he wasn't cooperative or something like that, or
indeed,
why he was doing things.
So presumably, I realize this is, in a sense, goes beyond your powers as a pathologist, but in terms of trying to see justice done, presumably these other questions will then be introduced by the lawyers, particularly his defense team, as to how far there was intent and how far there could have been other factors that contributed to this police officer, I guess they will argue, inadvertently causing his death?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. There may be other factors involved, and certainly when we say homicide, when I say homicide, that's a medical conclusion, not a legal conclusion, because homicide can be criminal or not criminal, you know, justifiable homicide. If somebody's executed by the government, that still is a homicide. But my opinion has to do with why he died. The other factors that you mentioned are argued at a different level beyond my pay grade. That's true.
In terms just of how this works and how American justice works, explain to me this idea that you have, you have been brought in privately and independently in order to carry out another autopsy, give the family, in a sense, a second opinion on the death of George Floyd.
Yes.
In what way are the jurors, when this reaches trial, expected to evaluate the conclusion that you have drawn? And you've got a reputation over the years for drawing strong conclusions that sometimes go against what the official account is, and in this case, you know, what the medical examiner for the city of Minneapolis decided was the cause of his death.
The system in the coroner or medical examiner system here in the States is there's always room for a second opinion. But I think that second opinions are becoming increasingly more common in the United States in all parts of medicine. Many insurance plans require, before surgery is done, that a second opinion be made by another independent doctor to make sure they're not doing unnecessary surgery, for example. Same thing here with deaths. If the family is concerned that there might be a mistake made or something overlooked, or if they want a result quickly, they hire another forensic pathologist to do a second autopsy. Because in the normal course, it often takes months before the family gets a result. And this way, they can get a result within a couple of days.
That was the forensic pathologist, Dr. Michael Baden, who carried out an autopsy on George Floyd on behalf of his family. With Iran now experiencing a second wave of coronavirus infections, it's thought that as many as 50,000 people there may have died from the virus. If true, this would be more than six times the latest official statistic of 8,300 announced by the country's health ministry this week. International health experts believe that the Iranian government's wish to downplay COVID deaths, combined with limited and inaccurate testing, could be disguising the true impact of the disease. The news follows a recent flurry of unverified videos on social media showing people lying in the street suffering from what appeared to be coronavirus-like symptoms. Our correspondent, Mike Thompson, has this report.
Ali, an Iranian documentary maker, lives in Tehran with his wife and young children.
At the start of the pandemic in Iran, I was afraid. I was so scared to walk in the street. I ordered anything that I needed online.
Ali's fears were warranted.
Three of my relatives passed away because of the coronavirus infection. But this second wave, I've seen the figures and numbers rising up. I hope it stops. I really do.
Ali says some started drinking alcohol, forbidden in this Islamic country, after hearing on social media that it could cure coronavirus. Although the first suspected cases of coronavirus hit the country around mid-January, there was no official declaration until several weeks later, when people had already started dying. Nursing staff, like these, in some Iranian hospitals, tried to lift the increasingly dark mood sweeping the country. But the death toll kept rising. Hajia Rahmandad is Associate Professor of System Dynamics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Our estimates suggested that the magnitude of death in March was about
10 times larger than the official numbers, and the magnitude of epidemic itself might have been closer to 40 times the official numbers.
Your organization has been quoted as saying it could be as high as 50,000.
I cannot be sure. It may actually be not far off either.
How high do you fear the death toll could go in Iran if things carry on as they are?
I'm hoping that the total number of deaths in the country will remain under 100,000 once we are done with this epidemic.
The laboratory confirmed cases are not a full reflection of the total number of COVID deaths.
Dr. Christoph Hamelmann, the World Health Organization's representative in Iran, says it's impossible in any country to accurately gauge the number of deaths or infections purely by lab tests alone, given that these are both limited in number and not always accurate.
The likely infection is by a factor of 3 to 5 higher.
So could the number of deaths in Iran from COVID-19 be 3 to 5 times higher than is currently stated?
Theoretically it could, but practically we do not have the data for it.
Even some of the Iranian government's own health officials have openly said they believe the official mortality figure of more than 8,000 deaths is at least half the real number. This chimes, perhaps surprisingly, with claims by the controversial exiled opposition group, the National Council of Resistance of Iran. Its campaigning statements are often dismissed as purely partisan, but the group's research, involving data from some Tehran hospitals, seems in keeping with the conclusions of others. NCRI spokesman Dr. Ali Safavi.
These 17 hospitals are 17 out of 138 hospitals that admit coronavirus patients. And based upon the figures that we have obtained from multiple sources, at least 10,000 have died in Tehran alone. That's already 2,000 more than the national figure that the regime has announced.
If the worst death toll estimates are accurate, public attitudes may be partly to blame. Recent surveys show that a majority of people in Iran no longer support social distancing or self-isolation. And according to Marzia Ghiabi, research fellow at the University of Exeter, less than a third have even cancelled their holidays.
If we consider the situation of crisis that the Iranian population has gone through over the last few months, it is still a conspicuous number of people decided to travel. And they have traveled to the northern regions of the country, which have been amongst the most affected.
Ali in Tehran watches anxiously through his window at the streets below. He and his family have long craved a return to normality, but he fears that rushing this is only likely to make things worse.
It is scary seeing how people are coming back to normal way of life, gathering up, going to parties, going on vacation. It is seriously scary.
That was Ali, a documentary maker in Tehran, ending that report by Mike Thompson. And there's been controversy today in another country that's been hard hit by the virus, and that's the United Kingdom, because a leading scientist whose modelling helped convince the government in London to put the country into lockdown has said that more than 20,000 lives could have been saved had the measures been brought in just a week earlier. Professor Neil Ferguson, whose advice was crucial to the decision in the end to go into lockdown, said the outbreak had been doubling in size every 3 or 4 days before measures had been taken. You're listening to NewsHour. And a reminder of our top story this hour. Philonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, the African-American man who died while being restrained by US police, has told a congressional committee that people around the world are demanding changes to policing practices.
Justice has to be served. Those officers, they have to be convicted. Anybody with a heart, they know that's wrong. You don't do that to a human being. You don't even do that to an animal. His life matters. All our lives matter. Black lives matter. I just wish I can get them back. Those officers, they get to live.
This is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. Archaeologists have uncovered what's thought to be London's first purpose-built theatre. The Red Lion in what's now Whitechapel dates back to the mid-16th century, and it was founded by two actors and impresarios who eventually gave a young William Shakespeare his break in the 1590s. Stephen White is the lead archaeologist on the dig. He's been speaking to my NewsHour colleague, Jason Mendes.
What we had surviving was we had a large timber structure that matched the dimensions that we know of from some 16th century lawsuits. And arrayed around that, we had a large alignment of post holes of various dates that indicate a large above ground structure that relate to the scaffolding that's also described in these 16th century lawsuit documents.
What sort of conditions is it in?
It wasn't in the best condition, I'll be honest. The timbers, when we uncovered them, were very, very, very heavily degraded. So while we were on site, we had to, on a daily basis, damp them down and preserve them as best as possible. We knew that there's only so much we could do. We had intact remains, but they were very, very soft, very fragile. I mean, they were not really long for survival anyway. So our job on site was to record them to the absolute best of our abilities. And to this, we've done elevations, done plans, we did 3D modelling, and now those timbers are gone.
How significant is this? I mean, my understanding is that people knew about the Red Lion, but were arguing about where it might have been. You think you've found it, so I guess this is quite a big deal, isn't it?
It's a pretty big deal. It's a pretty big deal. It's very exciting to be a part of this. The Red Lion, it's at the dawn of the Elizabethan theatre. The person who built it, John Braine, is kind of one of those unsung heroes of this period. Prior to the establishment of the Red Lion, he was kind of a footnote in history as the brother-in-law of James Burbage. Braine and Burbage together go into business about 9 years after the construction of Red Lion to build the theatre in 1576. And the theatre is the place where William Shakespeare eventually produced his plays in the 1590s. So this is key to that evolution from what we know of touring playing groups to eventually groups that resided at a particular venue and only put on plays there. So it's very much at the transitional period from this sort of less professional playing maybe to a much more professional playing environment.
And what sort of plays were put on? I mean, was this sort of regarded as pretty bawdy stuff by some?
Well, that sort of period, you're very much in that crossover between ecclesiastical productions and the more secular productions. Again, as you say, bawdy is probably a very good term for the stuff that's probably put on at that point. With regards to the Red Lion, we only know of one particular play that was put on there that again is referred to in legal documents, and that was the play of Samson, which is a lost play that no one really knows who wrote it or much about it. I mean, obviously, Samson's a biblical figure, so he's sort of transitioning away from biblical playing is still in process there.
And so the materials that you have been able to salvage, what's left of it? I mean, what's going to happen to that?
So the development that's currently being undertaken, they are putting up various plaques to show where stuff was. A Red Lion Square they're going to be putting into the development to sort of signify its relationship to what was there in the past. In regards to what we have tons and tons of material culture, 3D scans of the timber structure. Our current goal is we're going to take what we have and we're going to create reconstruction so you can see how what we had in the ground relates to what would have been standing there at the time.
That was the archaeologist Stephen White speaking to my colleague James Menendez. Just over a week ago, New York City woke up to the aftermath of looting in Manhattan and the Bronx. Largely peaceful protests against the killing of George Floyd were followed by violence and theft. In Manhattan, it was mostly big-name storefronts which were smashed in, but in the Bronx, it was small businesses, often owned by people of colour, which were destroyed. Lord Trevelyan has this report.
The subway trains run overhead. Jessica Betancourt shows me the steel shutters that were supposed to protect her optician store in the Bronx. Instead, looters used a crowbar to smash their way in. Security cameras captured the devastation as men in masks stole eyewear and snatched $13,000 from the safe. Jessica is reeling at what happened hours after the peaceful protests against George Floyd's killing.
It's hurtful because you think about the peaceful protests and George Floyd, and they're destroying his memory. And one thing doesn't have to do with the other. As small businesses, we're getting destroyed because it's like they have an opportunity. This is their opportunity to destroy our community.
So this week, there's hammering and drilling as store owners in the Bronx rebuild. They'd hope to be reopening. New York City is finally easing the coronavirus lockdown.
That wasn't a march gone left. It wasn't a protest gone wrong.
The Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. has spent years encouraging people of color to invest in this neighborhood and own their own businesses. He has this message for the looters.
You can't say no justice, no peace. You can't march against systemic racism and then take shots and break windows and loot the stores that are owned by minorities that are addressing inherently systemic racism.
So many different inequalities are colliding in the Bronx right now. The looting of small businesses, the coronavirus epidemic that disproportionately killed people of color, mass unemployment as a result of the shutdown. And because of all of that, now more people are going hungry.
Outside a Jewish community center, a volunteer hands out food parcels to people who receive them gratefully. This food pantry is now serving twice as many people as it did before the pandemic. With unemployment in the Bronx at 16.5%, David Edelstein, who's worked here for 43 years, has never seen need like this.
People who had small businesses, people who worked as custodians all their lives and never thought of taking anything from anybody, proud people who car mechanics and janitors and waiters and cooks, they were never thinking of getting financial help from somebody else. And they come, and some of those are the ones who cry.
Jessica Betancourt cried when she saw the damage done to her optician store, the shattered glass everywhere. But she wants to serve this neighborhood.
Are you hopeful that you can move on from this? We cannot forget it. It's not something that you can just erase and forget and just move on. Sometimes there's a small fear of what's going to happen, but we're going to move on. And we're going to open the doors and we're going to service our patients just the way we did a year ago when we opened, and just be positive.
So many in the Bronx are used to hardship and poverty. Now they're dealing with the aftermath of chaos on the streets and a pandemic which has laid bare the fault lines of race and poverty in American society.
That was Laura Trevelyan reporting from the Bronx in New York and bringing this edition of News Hour to a close from all of us here, from me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London. Thank you very much for your company.
News Hour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.